Hello, folks. I want to welcome you to First Thursday. This is Labor Relations Information Systems' monthly podcast on recent developments in public safety labor issues. My name is Will Aitchison, and I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so while we sort of dance around the country this month talking about cases that have come down from police, fire, corrections, workplaces, and what's of interest that might impact you. I want to start, though, with kind of a personal note. I want to thank all of you for listening, and occasionally for those of you who send something in saying that you appreciate these podcasts. This is still sort of a novel form of communication for us, and while I listen to every sort of podcast, I never really thought until a couple years ago that we'd ever do one or be capable of doing one, and I'm just thrilled that you find enough value in the information that we're putting out on the podcast to continue listening, and thanks for doing that. All right, let's start with a light topic, something easy, something non-controversial, religion. Actually, you know, we do have, from time to time, religious cases coming into the public safety workplace. And they come in a wide variety of different forms. There are a bunch of what I think of as reasonable accommodation cases. And this is where an employee is saying, I want you to reasonably accommodate my religion by doing this, whatever this might be. One of the big cases here came out of the Carson City Sheriff's Office in Nevada, where what the recently hired police officer, deputy sheriff, what she wanted was she wanted to have Saturday off because her religious beliefs, and I forget what religion exactly she was, her religious beliefs designated Saturday during the day as the Sabbath day. And the question was, did the employer have to reasonably accommodate her Sabbath day by assigning her to a Saturday off? Or did the union contract clause that called for seniority prevail? So there's a bunch of those sorts of cases where some request is being made for an exemption from the employer's rules based on religious beliefs. You see this sometimes in the corrections workplace, where corrections officers are required to wear pants. There's a big case out of New York where a group of female corrections officers said it's against our version of Christianity to wear pants, and that is sinful. So we want you to reasonably accommodate us by allowing us to wear a skirt. So that's our first category of cases, these reasonable accommodation cases. You also see from time to time what are called establishment cases. Really, there are two parts to the First Amendment's freedom of religion guarantees. There's the freedom that we all have that's known as the ability to freely exercise our religious beliefs. It's known as the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, where an employer or the government cannot stop us from freely engaging in our religious activities, subject, of course, to some very common sense limitations. The other half of the First Amendment that you see come up from time to time is establishment clauses, and this is where the employer wants to or takes some action that actually endorses religion. There was a big case that came out of Milwaukee County, that controversial sheriff that they have there in Milwaukee County. His name's David Clark. You probably see him on Fox News all the time saying this or that. Well, Clark was once sued because he was endorsing, through the roll call process and other processes in the department, his particular view of Christianity, and a federal court ended up having to get involved in the whole thing and found his actions to violate the First Amendment. So I've now described three types of religious cases that somehow make it into the public safety workplace. I've talked about reasonable accommodation cases, establishment cases, and free exercise cases. This new case I want to talk about isn't any of those things. It falls in the fourth category. And the fourth category are people who are alleging that they are being discriminated against because of their religious beliefs. This is a firefighter case. Comes out of a fire district in Spokane County, Washington. Spokane County is a partly metropolitan, partly rural county in northeastern, and tucked up in the northeastern corner of Washington, right up there against the Idaho border. And this case involves a fire captain by the name of Jonathan Sprague. All goes well with his employment for a long time, but then he forms something known as the Spokane Christian Firefighters Fellowship. No problem there, right? Because anybody's free to form any religious organization that they want to. But the problem comes in 2011 when Captain Sprague begins distributing newsletters and meeting notices for the fellowship through the department's email system. And they these newsletters and meeting notices often contained passages from the Bible. They mentioned the topics that were going to be discussed at the meeting, and those topics were explicitly religious. So what you have is a firefighter, fire captain, using the department's email system to communicate about religious topics. The department, of course, gets involved pretty much right away because some firefighters object to this. They follow other religions or no religion. And the department reminds Sprague of its email rules. And those rules say our email system can be used for business purposes only. And the department says cut the religious references out. This is reinforced for Sprague, but he's not willing to take it lying down. He complains. He complains publicly that the policy, as applied to him, constitutes religious discrimination. That brings a fire commissioner to the scene who gets involved, and he directs Sprague, and here's the quote as to what he tells Sprague to not do. He said, "Don't use department email to post, discuss, or in any way disseminate communications that are sent for any purpose other than official department business." So in other words, you've got to follow our content-neutral email rules. By content-neutral, I mean that those rules don't discriminate on the basis of what the content is. Instead, what those rules do is to simply say, if you're going to be using our email system, it has to be concerning department business. If it's not, and we don't care whether it's the latest concert coming through town, religious email, or you know whatever the latest viral meme might be, don't use the email system. Sprague declines to follow the policy. And he continues using the department email system to distribute information about the meetings of the fellowship. He also continues to put scriptural passages in the emails. And he also posts excerpts from scripture on department bulletin boards. The department this time reacts by disciplining him. He continues to engage in the same conduct. The department follows progressive discipline. Sprague keeps on posting, and eventually the department fires him. He then sues, alleging that his termination violates his freedoms of speech and religion. He files in state court because he's filing a state cause of action under the Washington Constitution, but and a Washington anti-religious discrimination statute. He's filing in state court, but really these same principles would apply in any state when the First Amendment is being concerned. And how does the court deal with this? The court says, well, first of all, let's look at the government as an employer. Because we know the First Amendment, we know free speech, free religion, protections. We know they apply to the government. And The government as an employer, though, is in somewhat of an odd position, because sometimes the place where speech or religion may happen is in a public forum regulated by the government. Think, for example, the nativity scene issue, whether they can be put up in a public park. Sometimes it's in a public forum, and sometimes it's in a non-public forum. And if the communication, the speech, the religious communication, if the communication is in a non-public forum, then the only question is whether the employer's rules restricting the communication are reasonable and viewpoint neutral. And with that predicate firmly in its back pocket, the court then turns to the Spokane Valley Fire District's rules. And what the court ends up saying is, look, there's no question about it. This is content neutral. I'm quoting here. The policy of this state, expressed in the Ethics in Public Service Act, that's a state statute, is that public resources are to be used for official public business rather than for personal benefit. It would destroy the concept of a non-public forum to hold that limiting the use of a government computer system to government business was not reasonable. Accordingly, the policy was reasonable, and because Sprague was unwilling to comply with it, his termination did not violate any religious freedoms that he had. I have a couple of things that I want to say beyond just simply recounting for you the court's opinion here. First of all, I think this case comes out the same way pretty much anywhere. You simply could not open up an employer's email system to any sort of communication without restriction. And I have a great deal of sympathy for the employer's position here, because religious communications can set off hot buttons, in particularly in a multicultural workplace. And it's just simply, I think, a good employment policy not to allow this sort of communication to go out through an email system. Secondly, I do want to note that this wasn't a unanimous opinion on the Washington Court of Appeals. It was a 2-1 vote, which means maybe we're going to see Sprague try to take this case to the Washington Supreme Court. What did the dissenting judge have to say? I've got to say, if you've got a spare 10 minutes or so, it's worth reading this opinion, because it's one of the most unusual ones I have read in many, many years in any federal or state court. And let me read you just the first paragraph of it that will give you the flavor. This is a Court of Appeals judge in Washington writing these words, and I quote, "Jesus Christ commissioned his contemporary and present-day disciples to teach others in the Christian faith. Religions, in addition to Christianity, also direct adherents to teach the religion's moral lessons, rules of conduct, and eternal values. Since a person of faith spends much time with his or her co-workers, fellow employees often become the focus of sermonizing. The religious devotee encourages, sometimes nags, co-workers with promises of happier days, a fuller life, and eternal salvation to adopt a different lifestyle. While proselytizing may annoy some co-workers, Washington proudly tolerates different religious views and braves open discussion of religion." So this judge is saying that an employer's email system, an employer's communication system, the entire workplace can be religious in nature without violating any laws or the First Amendment or whatever it might be. It's a fascinating view. I don't think it's going to get a majority opinion, if this case ends up with the Washington Supreme Court. So that's my little religious aside for today. It's kind of an interesting case. It's rare that you see an employee, particularly a middle-level manager like this, a fire captain, persist in the face of repeated progressive discipline in this manner. And I look at this case and I just dearly, dearly hope that this employee wasn't relying on bad legal advice that he got somewhere along the line. Okay, let's shift gears. Let's shift from police to fire, fire to police, and let's shift from Washington to Louisiana, and let's talk about a statutory peace officer's Bill of Rights and a kind of an interesting case that comes to us from the Louisiana Court of Appeals. Just a little backdrop here. A peace officer's Bill of Rights by statute in statutory form exist, I think my count is, in 17 states, one way or another. There are far fewer firefighter Bill of Rights, but there are still several across the country, but not nearly the 17 that there are for peace officers. And these Bills of Rights cover the entire disciplinary investigation process, and they typically key into the word interrogation, and provide that employees have certain articulated rights in the event that they are the subject of a disciplinary interrogation. And so it is with the Louisiana Peace Officers Bill of Rights. And if an employee is interrogated, there's all sorts of requirements. They have to be allowed to record the interrogation, for example. They have the right to an attorney. All sorts of different rights spin off the question of whether or not something is an interrogation. Okay, that's part of the background. Now the other part of the background, because for some of you, what I'm about to discuss in this case will seem foreign. I've not counted the number of states that do so, but many states in this country ban the use of the polygraph examination as a condition of continued employment for a public safety employee, even police officers. That's true, for example, in my state, in Oregon. It's true in to the north and south of me, and in Washington and California. There's statutes all over the country that ban the use of the polygraph. But not everywhere. And some states do continue to allow the use of the polygraph examination. It's an exercise that is fraught with peril on the part of an employer, because the evidence isn't really good about the reliability of the polygraph examination. They'll get more reliable in the future, right? I mean, as we're able to wire our brains into computers, we'll certainly have a pretty clearly reliable polygraphs. But the latest figures that I saw on the reliability of polygraphs are that they're reliable about 62% of the time, which is better than tossing a coin, but it's probably nothing you want to bet your career on one way or the other. When I talk to police officers, when I talk to polygraphers, they'll tell you that the best use of the polygraph is as an interview tool. That if you sit down with somebody in front of a polygraph, you're going to get a lot out of them when you talk to them that you might not get if you didn't have that machine right there. So why is the polygraph fraught with peril? The reason it's fraught with peril is that the results of polygraph examinations are not admissible in federal court. Federal courts have long taken the position that polygraphs are not reliable enough to be admitted into evidence. And so you end up with these odd cases. I'll give you one out of Idaho right now. An odd case where this was a police lieutenant who was fired for failing a polygraph examination. He brought a lawsuit saying, hey, that was a pretext. You were really discriminating against me. The employer in trial wanted to put into evidence that this guy failed a polygraph examination, and the court ruled it off limits. The employer was unable to enter into evidence the single most important piece of information on which it relied. And the result was a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar judgment on behalf of that lieutenant. So there's risk in using polygraph examinations, but they're still used in a lot of places. And one of the places they're used is in the city of Gonzales, Louisiana. This is a case involving Davin Miller. Now, Miller's a police officer for Gonzales. He was the subject of an internal affairs investigation. It stemmed from some sort of off-duty altercation that he had with his wife and her father. And it spills over, as these things often do, into an internal affairs investigation. This is a small police department, so the police chief is actually the one who is interviewing Miller to start with. And after the interview, the chief orders Miller to take a polygraph examination. Somehow or another, they arrange for this polygraph to be administered by what the court calls a special agent of the United States Secret Service. I wonder how that happened. And after the polygraph examination, the chief fires Miller, and he cites in part the results of the polygraph examination. Miller sues, and he contends his termination violated Louisiana's Bill of Rights. And what's the question? You know, I've seeded this field already for you, right? The question is a polygraph examination an interrogation covered by the Bill of Rights? Because if it was, then the employer here violated the Bill of Rights, didn't allow Miller to be represented by counsel during the polygraph, didn't allow him to record the questioning during the polygraph. If a polygraph is an interrogation, then the employer violated the Bill of Rights here. And the Louisiana Court of Appeals says it's an interrogation. The court says a polygraph examination is by its very nature a system of formal questioning, systematic questioning. If you look in Black's Law Dictionary, says the court, and who looks in Black's Law Dictionary except courts, right? If you look in Black's Law Dictionary and you look up the word polygraph, you will see the definition include the word interrogation. And it goes on to quote this definition of a polygraph in Black's Law Dictionary, which defines it as a piece of equipment used to determine whether someone is lying by measuring and recording involuntary physiological changes in the human body during interrogation. So the court says, look, it may be that the polygraph examination here of Miller really only consisted of two questions. It may be that the polygraph examination wasn't even terribly important in the decision-making process. That's not the problem. The problem is, and I'm going to quote from the court now, the questions asked of Miller were directly related to his alleged misconduct and were clearly asked to test the veracity of information obtained to support the imposition of discipline. We are constrained to conclude, we have to conclude, that the polygraph examination of Miller constituted an interrogation under the Bill of Rights. Given the fact that Miller's request to record the polygraph was denied, the disciplinary action cannot be maintained. The court says, look, you know, this penalty that the discipline is rendered and the phrase of the court is absolute nullity, we recognize that may be a harsh result, but you know what? That's what flows from the Bill of Rights. And if you want a change in the Bill of Rights, you got to go to the Louisiana legislature. You can't come to us. So, interesting result. Polygraphs are interrogations for purposes of a peace officer's Bill of Rights. I haven't seen that precise issue raised before. I want to now move up to Chicago and talk about the case of a fired Chicago police officer. And in particular, I want to talk about the question of whether or not an appeal can actually result in an increased penalty. Where public safety employees have some job protections, in other words, where they're not at-will employees, there are three common ways of appealing discipline. One is to arbitration. That's used in the majority of places. A second is to court. So, for example, if you're in New Jersey and you're a police officer, your appeal system places you firmly in court. And the third is to some sort of civil service board or a police or fire board, some sort of intermediate board before you get into court. We're talking about the third option here, a civil service board or a police or fire board. And it may surprise you to know that the law's been out there for a long time that if you're in that sort of appeal system, where you're appealing to a fire commissioner, police commissioner, whatever it might be, that the board, the hearing board, can actually increase the disciplinary penalty, and including it, the ability to increase the penalty to termination. And that's what happened with this Chicago case. This case involving a Chicago police officer, his name is Stephen Lesner, let me make sure I pronounce that right. Lesner's working, this is a February day in 2009. He and two other officers are in a beat car, and they respond to a domestic disturbance. And the domestic disturbance is between a woman by the name of Catherine Wieland and her boyfriend. They're in a beef at a restaurant in Chicago's North Side. The officers remove Wieland's boyfriend from the restaurant, and then the matter comes up as to what do we do with Wieland. Since Wieland lives nearby, Lesner thought it'd be a good idea for him to drive her home in his police car. Probably not a good idea, right? But that's what he did. On the way, Wieland asks Lesner to stop and buy her a bottle of wine, and he agrees. In uniform, he goes into a store, he buys the wine. They get to Wieland's apartment. Lesner helps Wieland carry her things inside. He stays for 40 minutes. He talks to Wieland and her brother and father, who live in separate units in this building. Wieland and her brother became concerned about, you know, what do we do with Wieland's car? It's back at the restaurant. Lesner agrees to drive them to the restaurant to retrieve the car. And before he finally gets back to the job, he gives Wieland his card on which he writes his personal cell phone number. And when Lesner's shift is over, he gets a call from Wieland. She says, let's go out for a drink. Lesner declines, but does accept her invitation to come over to her apartment for a drink and watch television. Wieland asks Lesner to go out and buy some wine on his way, which he does. And before he leaves the station to go over to her house, her apartment, he puts his duty firearm in his locker and straps his backup gun to his ankle. At the apartment, Lesner removes his backup gun from the ankle holster and places both the holster and the gun on the floor next to his seat. He said he thought he took off the gun when Wieland wasn't looking. But about an hour later, Wieland said she needed to take medication. She left the room, came back with a large pill box. Lesner has been drinking, excuses himself to go into the bathroom, and Wieland picks up Lesner's gun and shoots herself in the head, killing herself. Lesner initially wasn't even put on administrative leave. He was given other police duties for a few weeks, and then he gets returned to patrol duties, where he remains for 2.5 years until the superintendent of Chicago Police filed disciplinary charges against him. We're now all the way up to 2013. This event happened in 2009. While the disciplinary charges are pending, the superintendent of police and Lesner negotiate a stipulation under which Lesner agrees to accept the 60-day suspension. And the matter then goes up to the police board, and Chicago has a police board, to simply rubber stamp, at least that's what everybody thinks is going to go on, rubber stamp the stipulation. It doesn't. It rejects the stipulation and orders Lesner's termination. And Lesner then appeals to the Illinois Court of Appeals. And his argument is, There's no authority on the part of the police board to increase discipline. And the Court of Appeals squarely rejects that. It says, look, a reasonable construction of the statute and ordinance that govern this police board gives the superintendent only the authority to recommend discipline. It gives the police board the authority to hold a hearing, make its own findings of fact, issue a decision, and then the superintendent has to enforce the decision. This does not preclude the police board from rejecting the superintendent's recommendation and taking a disciplinary action that imposes a more onerous penalty. And the court ends up saying, look, the test here is whether what the police board ultimately did is arbitrary and capricious. And we don't think it is. The court doesn't focus on Lesner's interaction with Whelan and showing up at her apartment and, you know, all this sort of stuff. It focuses instead on whether the police board could enforce department firearms safety rules. And the court ends up saying, and I'm quoting here, although the officer may be off duty at the time of improper use of his or her weapon, case law doesn't draw on this distinction in regard to the seriousness of the misconduct. And here, Lesner's lack of care of his firearm, standing alone, not to even mention his what the court refers to as his complete lack of judgment in dealing with Whelan, his misuse of the firearm alone substantiates the board's decision to terminate him, and it upholds his firing. By the way, this sort of thing where the appellate body has the ability to increase discipline doesn't exist in arbitration. I've never seen that happen. This is really a feature of a civil service type system or a police board or police commission type system. I'm going to stay in Illinois and talk about another case. This is a bargaining case, and it's a fascinating topic. It comes up from time to time, various places around the country, including in the private sector, including before the National Labor Relations Board. And it's one on which there's no unanimity. There's a majority rule, and then there's a minority rule. And really, it depends on where you are in the country as to which rule applies. What's the issue? Put in its simplest legal terms, the issue is whether or not a waiver of the ability to bargain over changes in wages, hours, and working conditions, whether a waiver is in and of itself mandatory for bargaining. All right, how does this come up? These are negotiations involving firefighters in the village of Skokie, Illinois. They're represented by Local 3033 of the IAFF, and they get to impasse in bargaining. And in Illinois, impasses for police and fire are broken by binding arbitration. And where you have arbitration, it's the last step in the bargaining process, you're only allowed to take to arbitration proposals that are mandatory for bargaining. It becomes an unfair labor practice to try to refer to arbitration something that is either a prohibited subject of bargaining, it's against the law, or permissive subject of bargaining, meaning it's not mandatory. You can bargain about it, but you don't have to bargain about it. Only mandatory subjects of bargaining go to arbitration. So what are they arguing about? They're arguing about a clause that the village is proposing. This clause is referred to in this contract as an entire agreement clause. Probably some version of this exists in the collective bargaining agreements for every employer and union in the public safety workplace in this country. Some version of this clause exists. It's not always called an entire agreement clause. Sometimes it's called a complete agreement clause. Sometimes it's called an integration clause. They have different names, but they say essentially the same thing. Only this one goes a little bit further. So what is it the village is proposing? It's one sentence long. I'm going to read it to you. I'm sure the language will be familiar. The village and the union, for the duration of this agreement, each voluntarily and unqualifiedly waive the right, and each agrees that the other shall not be obligated to bargain collectively with respect to any subject or matter referred to or covered in this agreement, including the impact of the village's exercise of its rights as set forth herein on wages, hours, or terms and conditions of employment. All right, there's no clue that was written by a lawyer, is there? Well, what does it really mean? It really means two things, what that proposal means. It means, first of all, we're done. We've bargained over everything that we can think about, and we're waiving the right to bargain over anything that we could have raised in the present bargaining. All right? That's the first thing it could mean. The second thing it could mean, and does mean, is in addition to that, in addition to number one, if the village makes changes in wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment during the upcoming contract, the union waives the right to bargain over the changes. It's a prospective waiver of the right to bargain over midterm changes in otherwise negotiable topics. All right? So we've got these two halves of this single sentence here. And the question is, are they mandatory for bargaining? And it ends up getting decided by the General Counsel of Illinois' Labor Board, which is known as the Labor Relations Board there. And the General Counsel never really even gets to the first half of the clause, which, by the way, I do think is mandatory for bargaining. This is it. We're done. We've bargained over everything we could have bargained about. I do think that's mandatory for bargaining. Instead, the General Counsel focuses on part two. Can you prospectively, can you propose a clause that prospectively causes the other side to waive its right to bargain over midterm changes in mandatory subjects of bargaining? So here's what the general and the general counsel answers the question, no. And here's the rationale. And a bit of explanation. I think this is this general counsel does a real good job of explaining the rationale behind all of this. And so I'm going to quote like three, four sentences from the general counsel's opinion. He says, here, the employer's proposal is analogous to a broad zipper clause because it forecloses the union's right to bargain over unforeseeable matters that arise during the term of the contract, specifically the impact of the employer's exercise of its management rights. Here comes the zinger. The union cannot know the full impact of the employer's exercise of management rights, particularly where those rights are broadly stated. In fact, the impetus for the exercise of those rights may not have yet arisen at the time of the bargaining, and the employer itself may not yet know how it will exercise the rights that it is preserving. So what's the problem with that? To be enforceable, waivers have to be specific. They have to be narrowly drawn. They have to focus on particular issues. And if you don't yet know what the changes may be, how can you have a specific, narrowly drawn waiver? Also, says the general counsel, to be enforceable, waivers of the right to bargain have to be with a understanding of the full impact of the waiver. How can that be the case if you don't know what the employer's prospective changes might be? And the general counsel ends with this line, it is this uncertainty that renders the employer's proposal a permissive subject of bargaining, meaning not mandatory, can't go to arbitration, because the proposal seeks the union's waiver of midterm bargaining over some unforeseeable and unknown matters. All right. So, prospective waivers that are not clearly articulated, whether they're in a clause like this, a complete agreement clause, sometimes these are called zipper clauses, as the general counsel indicates, whether they're in a management rights clause. These prospective waivers aren't mandatory for bargaining. And I told you, there's a split in authority on this issue out there. What's the majority rule? The majority rule is what the general counsel in Illinois held, is that prospective waivers, not mandatory for bargaining, and neither side has the right to refer them to arbitration. What if you don't have arbitration? What if you're in meet and confer? There's a Florida case called City of Cocoa, if memory serves me well, where the employer attempted to unilaterally impose at the end of bargaining its last best offer, and its last best offer contained a management rights clause that had a waiver, and Florida's Public Employment Relations Commission said, you can't do that. You can't do that because it's not a knowing, intelligible waiver of the right to bargain. So that's the majority rule. These prospective waivers not mandatory for bargaining. The minority rule, and I know really of only one state that has held this, and it's Washington, and it's in an opinion that's never been picked up after like 20 years or something like that. The minority rule is these waivers are in fact mandatorily negotiable, meaning they can be sent to arbitration. Now, I want you to think about something that's pretty interesting here about permissive subjects of bargaining. Because in most states, those of you in New York, hold your ears right now because you have different rules than everybody else. But in most states, what does it mean that something is a permissive subject of bargaining? Well, first of all, as we've just seen, it means neither side has the right to refer that thing to arbitration. It also means if you're in a meet and confer environment, the employer can't unilaterally impose a permissive subject of bargaining. It can only unilaterally impose mandatory subjects of bargaining. That's the first thing that it means. But what if a permissive subject of bargaining finds its way into your contract? So, for example, lots of court opinions out there holding that police staffing is not mandatory for bargaining. That's a permissive subject of bargaining. What happens if you have a staffing clause in your contract? By the way, firefighter bargaining typically is thought to be mandatory for bargaining where it's phrased in terms of the number of firefighters per rig, per piece of equipment. But what if you got a police staffing clause? Let's say a clause that says there shall be 2.0 police officers per 1,000 population. And it finds your way into the collective bargaining agreement. Is it enforceable? Answer, yeah. If a permissive subject of bargaining ends up being incorporated into the contract, it is as enforceable as any other clause in the contract. But what happens when the contract expires? Does the permissive subject of bargaining continue in effect? Only if the contract stays in effect. And what if, for example, one of the parties wants to propose the continuation of the contract language that captures that permissive subject of bargaining? So what if that police union I was talking about that has this staffing clause of 2.0 per thousand, once the contract expires, it simply proposes the continuation of the current contract language, the continuation of the staffing clause. And most states will say, once permissive, always permissive. And it is an unfair labor practice for the union to propose the continuation of a clause even if it is in the collective bargaining agreement, if that clause is not mandatory for bargaining. That clause simply falls out of the contract if the other side objects to it. And this is why, and I think this is advice that lawyers on both union side and management side give to their clients, I know I've certainly given it to my clients over the years, is you don't want to have necessarily a hard and fast rule that you never, ever, ever put a clause in a contract that is a permissive subject of bargaining. But if you're going to do it, you better do it with a full understanding that when that contract expires, the other side can look at you and simply say, we've had enough. We object to it. It's permissive. And it simply falls out of the contract. In other words, don't buy language in a contract that is permissive for bargaining. Because when the contract expires, that bargain can be undone and only half of the bargain remains. So let's take the police union with the staffing clause. Let's say the police union paid dearly at the bargaining table for that staffing clause, gave up 2% in wages. And let's say you got a 3-year contract. At the end of the 3-year contract, the employer says, staffing, not mandatory for bargaining in a police environment. It's an unfair labor practice for you to propose the continuation of that clause. Well, the staffing clause will simply fall out of the contract. It'll be an unfair labor practice for the union to propose its continuation. But what about that 2% lower in wages that the union ended up with because of the staffing clause? That stays in effect. Only half of the bargain is undone. And that's why you never want to pay dearly to get language in a contract that is permissive for bargaining. I've been on the other side of that too, representing unions. I've been in bargaining where I've looked at the employer across the bargaining table and said, you know, you've got a management rights clause here that has waivers in it, prospective waivers, exactly what the Village of Skokie case was all about. You've got contract language that has prospective waivers. They're not mandatory for bargaining. We'd be willing to agree to the continuation of that management rights clause, but only if you give us more money, give us an additional 3%. So you tell us, how much is that management rights clause worth to you? So that's the sort of bargaining dynamic that can happen when you have permissive subjects of bargaining that somehow creep into a collective bargaining agreement. And while I can't say absolutely never, ever, ever do it, just understand you may have to buy that permissive language time and time and time again. And you at least better be figuring that possibility into the calculus of whether you want the continuation of that contract language or to propose it to begin with. Well, that's it for our first Thursday. And I'd like to suggest that you join us at our webpage, LRIS.com. In particular, take a look at the new system that we have for developing apps. It's really cool. We've now got people all over the country using our app development system. Great way to communicate. We're offering it right now to police and fire unions, although we're going to eventually offer it to employers as well, because it is a great way of communicating with employees. So take a look at our app development tool. If you have any questions, give us a call. In the meantime, stay safe, and I look forward to talking to you in November for our next edition of First Thursday. This is Will Aitchison signing off.